for them to think about for their opening 10-minute statements is to share some memories and impressions about your experience at the retreat and how those conversations may have resonated with later experiences. And we'll open up with the last introduced, Jim.
You all speak Latin, so I'm going to start with three Latin words. Domine ut videam. This Latin prayer was used in Merton's remarks at the opening session of our peacemaking retreat held at the Abbey of Gethsemane in November 1964. Lord, that I might see. The Latin words come from St. Jerome's Vulgate translation of St. Mark's Gospel. It's Bartimaeus' appeal to Jesus to heal his blind eyes. Domine ut videam. Lord, that I might see. Looking back on that small gathering 50 years later, it strikes me that these few words were at the heart of our retreat. Peacemaking begins with see. Peacemaking begins with see. Seeing ourselves in relation to the world we're part of, seeing what is really going on around us, and seeing the image of God not only in friends but in enemies. Blindness and its healing is a major topic in the New Testament, and not only concerning those like Bartimaeus, whose blind eyes cannot tell the difference between noon and midnight. I'm thinking of those with eagle-like eyes who can read the small print on an insurance contract but fail to notice that we live in a maze of miracles in which God is, as declared in the Orthodox prayer, everywhere present, filling all things. What we see and what we fail to see defines who we are and how we live our lives. Our constant challenge is to be aware of the divine presence and at the same time be alert to the demonic, to be able to tell the difference between what safeguards life and that which destroys. At the retreat, the theme of seeing was dramatized by the presence among us of A.J. Musty, who was then 79 years old. A.J. was one of the true sages of the American peace movement. For many years, he'd been secretary of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and was now chairman of the Committee for Nonviolent Action. He had devoted years of his life working for nuclear disarmament, and before his death in 1967, would play a pivotal role in efforts to end the Vietnam War, which was then in its early stages of U.S. involvement. It's not what A.J. talked about during that retreat, important though it was, that I recall most vividly. It was the fact that A.J. could see. Just days before the flight to Kentucky, A.J. had undergone successful surgery for cataract removal from both eyes. At the Abbey of Gethsemane, A.J. was in a constant state of amazement, seeing everything as if he were Bartimaeus. I've never seen anyone look at the world around him so attentively, so full of awe. He made me think of that sentence from G.K. Chesterton, "I'm astonished that people are not astonished." A.J. was in a state of ultra-astonishment. It was a contagious condition. I think he helped us open our own eyes a little bit wider. One of the elements of the retreat was taking a fresh look at the technology that the technological society we were part of. Technology, on the one hand, that has the potential to solve many problems. Merton, in his journal written in that period of his life, remarks from time to time on how grateful he is for the Coleman lantern that illuminates his electricity-free hermitage. And on the other hand, technology that can destroy cities in a blinding flash while incinerating millions of people. Again, the problem of sight. We are a species that has great difficulty seeing ahead, seeing the difference between the constructive and the destructive. One of the sentences that stands out in my memory of the retreat is this: if it can be done, it must be done. Once a technological possibility is envisioned, we are drawn to making the vision real, as irresistibly as if Pandora was drawing open again the chest that had served as a prison for evil spirits. The challenge of being members of a technological society is developing a capacity to envision consequences. For example, that a weapon once made is sooner or later likely to be used, and when that happens, it will mainly kill innocent people. For me, the most haunting question Merton raised with us was initially expressed in another Latin phrase, and you've heard it already, qua warento, By what right? By what right do we protest? In the context of the retreat, that was the question that itched, was an itch on our backs that we could not quite reach. By what right do we protest? It wasn't a question I'd ever before considered. I was born into a radical family in which protest was a normal activity. Protest against economic injustice. Protest against segregation and racism. Protest against war, etc. Well, not by nature a person drawn to protest. As a young adult, I found myself seeing protest as an unfortunate necessity. By the way, I still think of it that way. I've never enjoyed protest. I could not watch preparations for nuclear war and fail to raise a dissenting voice or refuse to participate in actions of resistance. To protest was a duty, period. But by raising the by what right question, Merton forced me to consider that protest, if it is to have any hope of constructive impact on others, has to be undertaken not only with great care, but with a genuine sympathy and compassion for those who object to one's protest, who feel threatened by it, angered by it, who regard you as a traitor. After all, what we are seeking is not just to make some noise, but to help others think freshly about our social order and the direction we're going. As Merton put it in a letter to me several years later after the retreat, peacemaking is in fact, as he put it, an apostolic work. Work that seeks to continue leading ourselves and others on a path to conversion, my own conversion, which is quite unfinished, and the conversion of the other. We need to remember that no one is converted by anger or self-righteousness. One has to use the hammer of protest very carefully. Protest can backfire. Protest can harden people in their opposition. Protest can bring out the worst in the other. In fact, to really be effective, protest needs to be animated by love. Not love in the sentimental sense, but in the sober, biblical sense of the word. As St. John puts it, whoever says he loves God but hates his neighbor is a liar. Another way of putting it is this: until we love our enemies, we're not yet Christians. Once again, seeing is the challenge. For that to happen, we have to see our neighbor, even if currently possessed, as far as we can tell, by evil, with God's eyes rather than our own. To see our neighbor as much as we can. God's eyes rather than our own. It's a question of seeing. One of the people we talked about at the retreat was Franz Jägerstätter, a man few had heard of at the time. Franz Jägerstätter was an Austrian Catholic farmer who, for his refusal to collaborate with the Nazi regime, was beheaded in Berlin on the 9th of August, 1943. Jägerstätter saw with amazing clarity what was going on around him. He was aware of the demonic character of Nazism. He spoke out clearly and without fear to both neighbor and stranger about the hell Hitler's movement was rushing into. And he quite freely paid for his peaceful resistance with his life. He has come to be widely recognized as the patron saint of conscientious objectors. A few years ago, he was beatified at the cathedral in Vienna, but during his lifetime, no member of the Austrian or German hierarchy declared that it was a sin to join the Nazi party or a sin to kill in Hitler's armies. We can say the bishops closed both their eyes and their mouths, just as the vast majority of church leaders in the United States did during the greater part of the Vietnam War, and many wars that have since followed. A saint like Franz Jägerstätter, his eyes wide open, represents the holy act of saying, no. No, I will not be your obedient killer. No, I will not play it safe. I would rather die than take part in a parade to hell. Merton never spoke autobiographically during the retreat, but if one were to search the root structure of the retreat, one would have to recall Merton's decision made in the months prior to entering monastic life in December 1941, his decision not to bear arms in World War II, on the grounds that he could not envision Jesus killing anyone. as he wrote in the Seven Story Mountain in one of his most surprising passages, given the climate of the times, very surprising. God was not asking me to judge all the nations of the world or to elucidate all the moral and political motives behind their actions. He was not demanding that I pass some critical decision defining the innocence and guilt of all those concerned in the war. He was asking me to make a choice that amounted to an act of love for his truth, his goodness, his charity, his gospel. He was making me do this. He was asking me to do this, asking, to the best of my knowledge, asking me what I thought Christ would do. After all, Christ did say, whatsoever you have done to the least of these, my brethren, you did to me. Clearly for Merton, the foundations of the retreat go back at least 23 years. One of the results of the retreat was the role it played in shaping the Catholic Peace Fellowship, which was then in the process of formation. In November 1964, I was a journalist working for a New York City newspaper. Just weeks later, January 1965, I became the first person on the Catholic Peace Fellowship staff, soon joined by Tom Cornell, who still had a teaching job at the beginning of 65. Merton was the most renowned member of our advisory board, with Dan Berrigan, in effect, our chaplain. Our main work was assisting Catholics who were seeking recognition as conscientious objectors, people saying no to war and seeking instead to embrace a life responsive to Christ's declaration, whatsoever you have done to the least of these, my brethren, you have done to me. It all has to do with how we see. Domine ut videam, Lord, that I might see.
Thank you, Jim. Bob, why don't you share next, and then we'll close with Tom.